A federal court will hear arguments this week over whether twin towns on the Arizona-Utah border discriminated against non-church members. But the feds may be after something else, too.
DOJ is going after a much bigger fish. And what they want to do is to say the entire community is corrupt.
I'm Mark Brody. Also today on the show, a look at what's on the agenda with the legislative session kicking into gear, why the University of Arizona is setting up a one-stop shop for human rights-related issues, and moving history to make way for new development.
All of the properties between 3rd and 5th Street on the north side of Roosevelt were acquired and demolished. To look out my window here now and see everything gone, it's a little bit shocking.
Plus, a Valley City looks for a new brand and making safer flying suits. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Look for partly cloudy skies to stick around for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 68 degrees. That is the average high for today. Partly cloudy skies as well for tonight. Overnight lows in the upper 40s. Sunny skies on the way for tomorrow with a high of 69. It's partly cloudy and 65 degrees at KJZZ. A joint legislative committee is looking over Governor Doug Ducey's budget proposal today. Two ideas the governor supports are adding money to the budget for K-12 education and allocating funds to cut the backlog of cases being held up at the Department of Child Safety. Democrats are also hoping to promote their bill to restore a program supporting families in need. Senate Democrat Katie Hobbs says she hopes a bill expanding the temporary cash assistance program will be considered this session. Last year, Republicans okayed reducing the amount of time allowed on TANF from 2 years to one. Hobbs says 2,700 children rely on TANF for support.
Reducing these benefits will not help struggling families get out of poverty. It will only cause them to struggle more.
TANF recipients receive payments that average $200 a month per family. Democrats say restoring the program would cost the state about $4 million. Brian Kent is driving his small electric car to all of the lower 48 states because he can. From the KJZZ Science Desk, Sarah Hammond met up with him when he came to Tucson.
Electric cars are viewed as great means to take short trips without pumping carbon into the atmosphere. Freelance rider Brian Kent from upstate New York is demonstrating these vehicles are capable of cross-country journeys. Kent visited with the Tucson Electric Vehicle Association members last weekend to share his experiences and compare notes about operating an electric vehicle. Kent says more charging stations for electric cars will encourage people to switch to this form of transportation.
Infrastructure is limiting us from being able to all use electric vehicles because they're already capable of doing the vast majority of what people want them to do.
Kent says he hopes what he's learning on the road will help the industry build more charging stations. He has 12 states to visit before he returns home. He's planning to write a book about his journey and the people he's met. In Tucson, I'm Sarah Hammond for the Arizona Science Desk.
With the pomp and circumstance of the first week of the legislative session out of the way, many state lawmakers are getting down to work this week. Joining me to talk about what they're up to is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, what's the mood like down at the Capitol right now?
Well, it's hard to tell because the rank-and-file lawmakers got their briefing this morning on what's in the budget, and I think they want to take a closer look and see what's there. There's obviously some sentiment for more funding for the joint technical education districts, which the governor really has left out in the cold except for a three-year, $10 million a year grant. But a lot of them are focusing on individual priorities, what's important to them. You know, the problem of the legislature being in session is everybody's got an idea. And unfortunately, they're not always brilliant. So we're going to have a lot of hearings starting this afternoon on many of these.
And what's coming up? It sounds like there's a pretty significant bill coming up today.
Well, one of them has to do with the issue of medical marijuana. As you may remember, voters approved the Arizona Medical Marijuana Act in 2010 and listed conditions for which people can get marijuana if they have a doctor's recommendation. You know, things like cancer and glaucoma and severe and chronic pain. And it's kind of left up to the doctor. This bill by Kelly Townsend would say if you are a pregnant woman, even if your doctor thinks you might benefit from marijuana, it would be off limits to you. But the problem that they're going to have is that because the measure was originally approved by voters, you cannot make any changes unless you take it back to the voters. And the only way you can get around taking it back to the voters, it has to further the purpose of the original measure. Well, I can tell you, I've spoken to the proponents of the 2010 law, and they say that taking some people out of who's eligible does not further the purpose.
Other than the budget, are there any big issues or subject matters emerging as the subject of lots of bills or of a lot of interest?
Well, guns always become an issue here. Who can have them? What permission they have to have? Where they can bring them? Obviously, we've talked a little bit in the past week about Sonny Borelli's bill to allow guns on campuses, and that's college and university campuses in certain circumstances. There are issues about city and local regulations, who can tax it, who gets tax credits for them, and that's always going to be an issue. We haven't heard much on the abortion front, although I'm counting on at least one measure to try to cut Planned Parenthood from state funding for family planning services. You may remember the legislature tried to do that 2 years ago and was slapped down very firmly by a federal court saying, no, federal law and state law already says you can't use public funds for abortions, but these are funds being used for family planning, and you can't say that simply because they also provide abortions that they can't be eligible for Medicaid money for family planning. Water quantity, water quality is always an issue. And then, of course, the obligatory federalism bills. You know, we're superior to the federal government. They can't tell us what to do.
Last year's session was completed in pretty much record time. This year, obviously, an election year. All 90 legislators are up for re-election this year or election to some other position. Do you get the sense that this will also be a short session so folks can get back out on the campaign trails in their districts?
I don't think it'll be anywhere near as short as last year. There were a lot of hurt feelings at the end of last year by some people who said, look, so we rushed out of here because we were told, well, we got to do something because of the billion-dollar deficit. Well, turns out that billion-dollar deficit left us actually, you know, something like $300 million surplus by the end of the fiscal year, and the revenues are running ahead. And I don't think lawmakers want to be stampeded into making certain spending decisions until they actually have the most up-to-date revenue figures. And that means at least getting some figures through March and possibly even into April.
Howie Fisher is Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks as always.
We're glad to be here.
A federal civil rights trial begins this week in Phoenix. The U.S. Justice Department is accusing two towns on the Arizona-Utah border of discriminating against people who are not members of a particular church. The church in question is the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, known as FLDS. From Phoenix, KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block reports jury selection is expected to wrap up today.
The rural towns of Colorado City, Arizona, and Hilldale, Utah are a single community divided by the state border. Fewer than 10,000 people live there. The majority belong to the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which is a polygamous sect. The Justice Department will be trying to prove the towns act as arms of the church and make it hard for outsiders to live there. One of their witnesses is Colorado City resident Isaac Weiler.
So it's very difficult, if you're non-FLDS, for instance, to get a simple water hookup that an FLDS member could get in a heartbeat.
Weiler, who's 50, grew up in the FLDS church in a polygamous family. But in the late 1990s, he didn't like the direction the church was going.
It seemed like we was headed towards really young marriages, and that really bothered me.
The church kicked Weiler out, but he refused to leave town. He now works for the Land Trust, which is at odds with the church. He says that's caused the local police, called marshals, to harass him and arrest him for trespassing. As part of the case, the Justice Department will try to prove the town marshals are loyal to their religion, not the law, and allowed illegal church practices, including marriages of underage girls to adult men.
The marshals department, the cities, they're all owned by the church. They're all just part of the church anyway.
The towns don't deny there used to be problems.
Jeff Matura is the attorney defending Colorado City. He says there were issues with the police years ago, but they were resolved, and the problem marshals are long gone. Matura argues there's an ulterior motive behind the government's lawsuit.
It really has turned into an effort by the federal government to eradicate a religion, the FLDS Church, that it disapproves of.
Over Matura's objections, the Justice Department is expected to present evidence about Warren Jeffs, an FLDS leader who was sentenced to life in prison for sexually assaulting two girls he took as brides. The federal government alleges the marshals helped Jeffs when he was a fugitive, and that Jeffs continues to run the church and the town from his prison cell. To win, the Justice Department must convince the jury more than just a few rogue town officials acted as arms of the church, and there was a pattern of discrimination. Notre Dame law professor Richard Garnett says this case gets to the core of what the First Amendment is about, preventing government from establishing an official religion.
This isn't going to be a matter of, you know, simply like how many Christmas carols were sung at the school holiday production. This is going to be much more about intermixing of power.
If the federal government is successful, it will seek monetary damages for victims of discrimination and town reforms, which could include placing some agencies in court receivership. I'm Jude Joffe Block in Phoenix.
It's the show on KJZZ, along with The Takeaway's John Hockenberry. Today, I'm Mark Brody. We learned today that the U.S. Supreme Court will review President Obama's executive actions on immigration, granting millions of undocumented immigrants legal status and work permits, a policy that in part has reduced the number of deportations to 235,000 from a record high of more than 409,000 in 2012. The legal challenge comes from Arizona, Texas, and 24 other states who oppose the Deferred Action for Parents of Americans program, which the president hoped would bring children of immigrants out of the shadows to get right with the law.
Joining me now, Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick and Jeffrey Rosen, professor of law at George Washington University and president of the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. Welcome, gentlemen.
Great to be here.
Hi, John.
So, Todd, we'll talk about the politics of immigration here for a moment, but let me just ask Jeffrey Rosen, is this the opening of states' rights season at the U.S. Supreme Court in the sense that this may be the first of many issues that the court looks at about presidential power?
There are a series of issues ranging from questions like abortion, immigration, and citizenship, and so forth. But what's so interesting about this case, it started as a kind of technical question about whether President Obama had violated the Administrative Procedure Act, which seems very technical. But the court added a really important question about whether he'd violated the constitutional requirement that the president take care that the laws are faithfully executed. And that suggests a real willingness to engage with the president on all of his executive orders and may well have broader implications.
So they're viewing, the challengers here are viewing the Deferred Action for Parents of Americans program as essentially a flaunting of intent of Congress.
That's exactly right. So very briefly, the Take Care Clause requires the president to enforce the law. Generally, the courts give the president a huge amount of discretion when he refuses to bring an enforcement action and generally defers to his discretion on this matter. But the states are arguing that he's failed to enforce immigration laws that Congress has already enacted and acting in the face of congressional opposition. There was an interesting memo that the Obama Justice Department wrote, which concluded that the deferred deportation of the kids would be fine, but for the parents would not be, because Congress had explicitly spoke to that issue. And the central question here is whether in deferring deportation of the kids, the president deserves deference or not.
Wait a minute, though. Hasn't the court already decided this? The Obama administration refused to enforce the Defense of Marriage Act, and the courts seem to suggest that was okay.
A great analogy there. The court said that was okay because it wasn't an administrative agency acting. Uh-huh. It was a Justice Department. So this is sort of technical questions of administrative law about whether the agency is acting under the authority that Congress has delegated. That's the difference between those two cases.
Jeffrey Rosen describing the substantial gray area that we're in here as we look at some technical legal questions that the Supreme Court will consider when it takes up this case and decides it before the term ends in June, which will be right in the middle of the presidential campaign. Todd Zwillick, even though there are a lot of legal issues here, in many ways, this is a mechanism of the Republican-dominated state government domain bringing a challenge that keeps immigration in the presidential campaign, right?
Oh, well, sure, but immigration hadn't really gone anywhere, and all of this is going to happen not only just before both the Republican and Democratic national conventions in July, as you mentioned, but also against a backdrop of nearly 10 years of dysfunction and debate in Congress over immigration. 2007, Congress tried for comprehensive immigration reform and failed. Of course, in 2013, we know that the Senate passed a bill, ultimately didn't go anywhere in the House, and that's led to some difficult and fractious politics between senators like Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, and of course, the front runner. And we have to talk about the front runner in the Republican race, because this is also happening against a backdrop where the Republican front runner hasn't really discussed the merits of DAPA or DACA or the Parents of Children Here Legally. This is a candidate who wants to deport all 11 million undocumented immigrants, build a wall along the border between the United States and Mexico, and while he's at it, keep out Muslims, even some of them who are Americans. And so, John, I also think, however, that the politics of this falls in two categories. One we just mentioned, deportation and immigration, a wide gulf between Republicans and Democrats there, but also something important that you hear a lot less about. Base Republican anger at President Obama on the executive power grab part that Professor Rosen was just talking about. This is a very important part of it as well. Maybe less energetic, but also important in Republican politics. Executive actions by the president on the EPA, the water supply, which we just talked about, guns, in some cases, health care and regulations around Obamacare, a lot of anger building in Congress and amongst the Republican base over years over what they see as illegal or overreaching actions by the president. And if the Supreme Court knocks that back in this case, they'll consider it a major victory against a power grab by a president who they consider imperial. The immigration question, however, will remain. This is a party, John, the Republican Party, Mitt Romney candidacy in 2012 lost Latinos by 38 points. 38. And these are two policies, DAPA and DACA, that remain incredibly popular with Latino voters, most of whom are Democrats.
I'm just surprised that the Republicans would go after this imperial presidency issue after Bush and Cheney, who were pretty imperial, especially when they understand, as you just said, the sort of consequence could be this utter alienation of Latino voters, which everyone says, every strategist says, is critical for the Republicans to win the White House.
Well, look, some of the rational or logical inconsistencies that you can point out in national politics now is really a symptom of the fact that base Republican politics on the state level and the local level is really separate from the consensus building that has to take place in Washington and in national elections. It's why many analysts consider the Republican chances for the White House so very difficult, at least that that path is narrow,
right,
for that very reason you just described, John.
Todd, let me just ask Jeffrey Rosen before we go. Half a minute, Jeffrey, is this another one of these what Kennedy thinks decisions?
Not necessarily. Kennedy has been ruled for the administration in an important case involving the Environmental Protection Agency, where he took a broad vision of executive power. It's one of those things that could have an unexpected breakdown, but Todd is absolutely right. The question of the future of executive orders is very much at stake.
Jeffrey Rosen, professor of law at George Washington University, president of the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, and Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks, guys.
You got it, John.
Thank you.
Coming up, building a one-stop online shop for human rights issues.
We feel that the people who really know human rights and are the true experts are the people on the ground around the globe who are fighting for these issues every day.
That's ahead. It's the show. Good Tuesday afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The show is bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news. Look for partly cloudy skies across the valley today with a high of 68 degrees. That is the average high for today. That was yesterday's high as well. It'll be partly cloudy tonight with overnight lows in the mid to upper 40s. Sunny skies for tomorrow, right on through really the rest of the week. Look for a high tomorrow of 69 up to 70 on Thursday. Right now in Phoenix, with relative humidity of 29%, partly cloudy skies, 66 degrees at KJZZ at 223.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Oncology, together with the U.S. Oncology Network, united to redefine cancer care, working collaboratively with patients' primary physicians to ensure the highest continuity of care. More at arizonaoncology.com.
You know, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day was yesterday, but did you know this week is No Name Calling Week? It's a national anti-bullying initiative started by the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network, or GLSEN. Danny Hernandez is with GLSEN Phoenix and says Arizona's anti-bullying policies are among the worst in the nation. He says focusing on something like name calling gets at the root of bigger issues.
And so taking, for example, saying something is gay or calling someone gay in a negative way, as if it is a negative thing, it promotes that, it perpetuates that idea.
To combat that problem, GLSEN provides resources for teachers year-round, as well as ideas for this week in particular. They can play videos for students, make classroom rules about name-calling, have students write poems, and more. Kyrene Apprende Middle School has opted for a Spirit Week. The students will arrive in their PJs tomorrow for Put Name-Calling to Rest Day. Alex Wong is a teacher there and helps organize the school's No Name-Calling Week each year.
We just see the kids reaching out to others that they don't normally talk to. We see them being just more naturally kind to one another. Middle school is kind of a tough age, so they sometimes need reminders on how to be just human to one another and be friendly.
Wong says bullying is something she and her fellow teachers confront year-round. She says the key to dealing with name-calling is to address it immediately when it happens, even if it's not during No Name-Calling Week. But how do advocates transition from their dedicated weeks or months into the rest of the year and keep their issues on people's minds? To help answer that question, I'm joined by Chris Bosworth, a professor in the Educational Leadership Program at the University of Arizona College of Education.
Anytime you do a public information campaign such as this, is you have it's a broad brush trying to hit a lot of people and to at various levels of various interests, and so that it is something that raises awareness, which is the first step in behavior change, and it could be raising awareness with so many people who have contact with young people or just contact with people. And, you know, what needs to happen for the next step is something that individuals may take on themselves. But usually awareness campaigns, the organizers are also thinking about what's our next step, what can we do to make changes in specific populations. And so if you're going to make change happen and continue it, you really need to be more focused on, you know, are you targeting teachers? Are you targeting principals? And if you're targeting the adults, what are the ways to help them be more focused about this?
How common is it for there to be a big public awareness campaign like this and then just to drop it at the end of the week or month or whatever unit of time they're using?
I think that is always a danger with this kind of activity, is that you raise awareness and then people, it's up to other people to take action, and they may or may not have the resources to do that. The action that they take is, say, it may not seem like this great action, but say a principal hears this and then sees a conference this summer and decides that he or she ought to send one of their teachers, or he or she ought to attend that conference and learn more about it. With a public awareness campaign, you don't know what kind of information you get. It's, in advertising, you want people to buy the product. Here, it's really a change of attitude that should lead to a change of behavior that you're after with a public information campaign.
It's interesting you said that, because I think for some awareness campaigns, there are sort of metrics you can use, like, for example, like blood pressure awareness week or whatever. Like, you can check to see, are more people going to see their doctor or other medical related things. But it seems like it would be more difficult to sort of gauge whether or not No Name Calling Week is having the kind of effect. It's tough to figure out whether or not there is less name calling going on in a school setting from one week to another or from one month to another.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree. You know, they would have had to, you know, in terms of figuring out if there's more people are getting their blood pressure checked, you have records in medical offices that you can do, you can go check in whether that you don't have that same kind of access to data about kids in schools. So yes, it's more difficult to check to see if that is, you know, there are attitude surveys that people have used with advertising campaigns.
Are there ways of getting that information short of going into the places where the campaign was taking place and just asking people?
I think probably that's the best way. I mean, I don't know. You could look at discipline referrals where they're in a school, where there are fewer discipline referrals for that kind of behavior. You would need cooperation from the schools and you know, to have... that would probably need to best be set up ahead of time in terms of what data are available and what data can be accessed by a group given the safeguards that we need to have for privacy.
Chris Bosworth is a professor in the Educational Leadership Program at the University of Arizona College of Education. A University of Arizona professor has created what he calls a one-stop shop for human rights-related issues. Bill Simmons, an associate professor in the U of A's Department of Gender and Women's Studies, says visitors to the website globalhumanrightsdirect.com can form groups, plan events, and find speakers to video conference, among other functions. So, Bill, what would you say is the overall goal of this site?
The goal is to bring people together to discuss human rights issues, especially people who haven't had a chance to engage in discussions about human rights. So often, the supposed experts in human rights are the ones teaching at universities, especially in developed countries. And we feel that the people who really know human rights and are the true experts are the people on the ground around the globe who are fighting for these issues every day.
What is the U of A's role in the site?
Yeah, the University of Arizona helps support the by providing a seed grant through what's called the Confluence Center for Creative Inquiry. It's an interdisciplinary center which provides seed money for faculty groups who are doing interdisciplinary work, and we received a seed grant from the Confluence Center a year and a half ago. The money was modest, but it was just what we needed to get this site off the ground.
Why do you think it is that the university was interested in being involved in a project like this? I mean, what's in it for the University of Arizona?
Yeah, I you know, there's the academic purpose of this, which is, you know, to broaden our knowledge about human rights from around the globe. But also, there's a kind of an entrepreneurial motive as well. We see this as being something that is sustainable and perhaps could become a spin-off company or something like that down the road.
Do you think that in some way that having this site and having people theoretically across the world contributing to it and looking at it, do you think that there's a chance that that will help improve the state of human rights?
Yeah, I mean, that's our goal, is to really change what counts as human rights knowledge, to change who's considered a human rights expert, and to get more voices from on the ground, people who've been marginalized in the past. And people aren't just marginalized by their governments and by other oppressive regimes. They're also marginalized sometimes by the human rights community. We have our pet issues and we have our go-to people, but we have a lot to learn from those people on the ground.
Is there a role for governments to be involved on this site as well?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question and something that we've debated among the group. And we feel that government officials play a major role in human rights, and especially in implementing human rights law, and so that it's important to get governments' views on human rights issues. And in fact, we've had discussions about whether perpetrators of human rights abuses could be allowed on the site, and we think that that would be quite valuable, and that there's a story that to be told, and that story could help us prevent further human rights abuses.
Do you think that that would potentially keep some people off or turn some people off of the site?
Yeah, we've debated that. And on these kinds of really tricky questions, instead of trying to answer them by ourselves once and for all, we've adopted kind of the ethos of the site, which is that we will tap into the expertise on the ground. So a major part of the site is a set of blogs to discuss these kinds of issues. And we're very much aware of issues like dealing with trauma. You know, many of the survivors who will be on our site have undergone quite a bit, and we don't want them to be re-traumatized by their engaging in video conferences or engaging in discussions. So we're very cognizant of that, and instead of answering those questions by ourselves, we really want to get a lot of people's input on those questions.
Bill Simmons is an associate professor in the Department of Gender and Women's Studies at the University of Arizona. The website is globalhumanrightsdirect.com. Bill, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Still to come on the show, STEM careers still lacking women of color.
And this is not a result of not being interested. There are lots of variables that are discouraging them.
We look at how to break down those barriers coming up. It's the show. Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on 91.5 or online, kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. One problem spot in Valley traffic on the 17 northbound. A crash at 7th Street blocks the shoulder. A reminder, you should probably be downloading the KJZZ mobile app. You can podcast this program as well as KJZZ's Here and Now. Many, many, many great functions on the KJZZ mobile app. It's totally free at the Apple App Store or Google Play. Download it now. Look for partly cloudy skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 68 degrees. It's 66 right now at KJZZ at 235.
KJZZ is supported by The Persian Room, health-conscious Persian cuisine for lunch and dinner, plus catering for your special occasions and business events. The Persian Room on Scottsdale Road, one light north of Bell, 480-614-1414.
In KJZZ News, Tucson will remain home of the global headquarters of the commercial spacecraft company Worldview after a vote this morning by the Pima County Board of Supervisors. The firm specializes in robotic flight and in taking passengers to near space in a sealed capsule. Worldview's co-founder Tabor McCallum says the company sealed the deal with Pima County after considering a move.
We were in an expansion competition, and the final states were Arizona, New Mexico, and Florida. And with the vote today by the Pima County Board of Supervisors, we will be calling Arizona home.
The company has already flown people to the edge of space three times. McCallum explains how it works.
So they go under a very large balloon to 100,000 feet. The highest we've flown a person is 136,000 feet, and then fly them back down.
Worldview is now selling tickets for $75,000 each. Brands are everywhere, from Nike to Coca-Cola. But does a city need a brand? Many of them are saying yes. Tempe City Council just approved a measure to award a more than $80,000 contract to a marketing firm to help brand their city. KJZZ's Lauren Gilger is with me. And Lauren, why did the city decide to do this?
Well, it started a few years ago with a request from social media savvy members of Tempe City Council. Here's Tempe's Public Information Officer, Nikki Ripley.
The city council came to us, and a few of them had wanted us to explore things like additional funds to apply toward Facebook boosting.
They brought in stakeholders and formed a subcommittee, but before spending money on social media, they decided to start at a more foundational level.
We wanted them first to be based on something real, to be based on research and real thinking, and not just necessarily us internally saying this is what we could spend money on.
So the city put out a request for proposals for marketing firms who could help them do research to shape a brand for the city to direct their communication for the next decade instead of the next few days.
What we want is for this to serve multiple purposes. We have many different audiences. Where a consumer brand would have maybe a narrow audience, they'd be able to define that they're aiming at 18 to 30-year-old women or something. A city has to appeal to a much broader array of people, and those are residents, those are commuters, visitors, the people who come to our downtown ASU students, people who come here for work, and companies who want to locate here.
One of the stakeholders they brought in was Dan Dillon, Chief Marketing Officer for Arizona State University. Before coming to ASU, he masterminded the campaign behind Coke Zero. So, Dan, why is it important for a city to have a brand?
Well, I think, you know, a brand is nothing more than a promise. It's what you can expect. And distilled down into a very tight set of words and signals and visuals. So I think cities, like all brands, like all products, are trying to differentiate themselves and project themselves in a consistent way, but in a way that's relevant and contemporary and attractive.
But you basically take the same model that you would take in branding Coca-Cola. Exactly. And brand a city.
You take the emotional objective, the emotional promise that you want to make, and you connect the features and functions of your product, whether it be a university or a city or a beverage, and you connect those. And so one has to be integral to the other. The features and functions of what you describe your brand having has to be integral to the delivery of this emotional consequence that you're promising you will have if you interact with the brand. And that's the fundamentals of marketing and branding that cross all sectors. The features and functions differ, obviously, but at the highest level, branding is about making a promise that's true and convincing people that it's what they want to consume.
If you, at this point, before this rebranding campaign launches, had to describe Tempe in a few words, how would you describe it?
Progressive, changing rapidly. The visual identity of this brand is changing rapidly, of the city is changing, the landscape is changing rapidly. Energy, the energy is a function of the youth that's here. It's a youthful place. I think that this is an up-and-coming city, and if you're continuously working at contemporizing your brand and you've got proof points that show that you are, like Tempe does with all the new buildings that are going up and the new retail that's coming into town and the number of restaurants that are opening, and then couple that with a university that's growing and at an unprecedented level, you've got a really progressive, forward-thinking, forward-leaning opportunity.
Mm-hmm. So as you take this forward, is it just a matter of solidifying that?
I think it's a matter of clarifying how you describe a city so that it is obvious and easy to digest. And then it's also the key part of a brand platforming exercise is understanding all the things that you could say about the brand, which ones are the best things to say to convince your constituents that you are that brand that you want to be. And that's oftentimes where brands get confused, is they want to say everything to everyone as often as possible. And a spamming strategy when it comes to brand building is not an effective strategy. You have to be really focused on what are the visual and verbal signals that best project the brand in the way you want to project it.
So it's not just a matter of a new logo or a new catchphrase. It's much deeper than that.
It has to be. In fact, the logo and taglines are always the end, not the beginning of these types of assignments. And the case of Tempe and Arizona State, we made that very clear, that it's first and foremost, what do you want to be when you grow up? And then everything has to connect to that. So the logo has to project that brand positioning and brand platform, not the other way around. And so we'll start with a broad look at the landscape of options on how to position Tempe in a unique way. And then we'll work backwards, and probably the last thing we'll do is come up with some logo and visual identity that represents that brand. And ideally, if you can distill it down into a tagline, that's great. But taglines, are just an expression of the overall brand platform.
That was Dan Dillon, Chief Marketing Officer at Arizona State University, who is helping Tempe in its efforts to brand the city.
KJZZ's Lauren Gilger. Lauren, thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
There have been a lot of efforts to recruit more students into the so-called STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math. ASU's Center for Gender Equity in Science and Technology aims to empower women of color and break down some of the barriers that make it difficult for these students to pursue careers in STEM. Kimberly Scott is the center's founder and executive director. Kimberly, are you mostly talking about the technical kinds of skills needed in STEM fields?
The interesting thing about the project is that, at least the way that we've crafted it, is that it's not simply about acquiring the technical skills. One of my colleagues, who was a senior executive in a STEM industry, indicated that one of the many characteristics that they look for in employees is not simply can you code, but there are other quote-unquote soft skills or social skills that many industries are not willing to teach, like how well do you get along with your teammates, how well can you collaborate, how well can you communicate your ideas, how well can you advocate for an item, how well can you be persuasive. A lot of times STEM efforts, science, technology, engineering, and math efforts, they tend to focus exclusively on those technical aspects. Let's teach a bunch of kids who don't have access to, whether it be the hardware, the software, or the opportunity, how to code or how to engineer or how to program robotics. Well, what we have found in our research, particularly from the field of social science, is that's insufficient. And so in constructing CompuGirls and also for establishing the center, we're trying to merge the technical with the social.
Have you found that young women of color especially don't have access to either the technical aspect or the social aspect, perhaps more so than other women?
I find that if we look at the statistics, which are rather depressing. If we look at, for instance, computer science, which is the fastest growing of all the STEM careers, we see so few women of color who are in programs. And this is not a result of not being interested. There are lots of variables that are discouraging them from going on. Those variables include a lack of belongingness or sense of belongingness, chilly environments, and then what we find in our research, most importantly, the cultural irrelevance.
That sounds almost more like an industry-wide or cultural-wide as far as the STEM fields kind of change as opposed to something that maybe you have to do for these particular students.
Yes, and that's one of the primary emphasis that we're attempting to assume at the center is it's not necessarily the individual that we're trying to fix. More importantly, what we see the disparity is a result of a system. And it's very, very complex. There's not going to be an easy answer. And the answer must include creating collaboratives, cross-pollination of ideas. So it can't simply be addressing issues from computer science or engineering. It needs to include a coalition of folk from many, many different areas.
Does that mean then that your job is sort of twofold in as far as preparing these students to enter the industry that exists, but also taking the industry that exists and trying to adapt it to these students who are attempting to enter it?
What we see are a couple of things. Absolutely providing women of color the skills in order to not only enter science, technology, engineering, and math fields, but then to have the skills to change the system so that it can be more equitable.
Do you get the sense that the industry in general is willing and able to make some of those changes?
I think it depends on the discipline. I think some disciplines are more understanding of the variables. I think some disciplines are still struggling with the ideas. I was talking to an industry in the Valley about the center and its work, and they were quick to say, we don't do anything with diversity. And I wasn't quite clear on how to take that, but what I did hear in that comment is there is a sense of, I would say fear, not necessarily reluctance, but fear out of not knowing. It's really going to take a culture shift.
Kimberly Scott is the founder and executive director of the Center for Gender Equity in Science and Technology at ASU. Kimberly, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. In Valley traffic, I-70 northbound, watch out for an accident at 16th Street blocking the shoulder there. It'll be partly cloudy across the valley this afternoon. Look for a high of 68 degrees. That was both yesterday's high and the average high for today. Partly cloudy skies stick around into tonight with overnight lows in the mid to upper 40s. Sunny skies on the way for tomorrow with a high of 69. Partly cloudy skies, 66 degrees at KJZZ at 250.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Education News, providing original reporting on education funding, reform, and legislative happenings to promote informed public discussion on Arizona's K-12 education. AZEdNews.com.
A professor at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Prescott is working on making a safer flying suit. The issue came to the forefront after a California man wearing a wingsuit died last week in a base jumping accident. Timothy Sestak is in the College of Aviation and has been involved in flying in one way or another for most of his life. So, Tim, where is this industry right now?
The industry is no longer in its infancy. It's been around since 1997, actually a little before then. People have been doing this since the 1930s. There were bat wings, and there were several air show performers that did wingsuit-type things back then. But I would say now the technology is rapidly being induced into the sport, and we're kind of a toddler.
So what are the biggest problems or challenges that you're trying to overcome at this point?
Well, I'm doing research on wingsuit aerodynamics because I am a wingsuit pilot, and I've been in the aviation my entire life. When I got involved in wingsuiting, it didn't fly like I wanted it to. And the things that I knew about aviation didn't apply to the wingsuit, and it didn't perform the way I wanted it to perform. So early on in the process, I took a big step backwards and looked at it and said, that's obvious. It doesn't fly because it isn't a good airplane. And I started looking at it through my aeronautical engineering eyes and realized that there were a lot of changes that could be made. Everything from the material that the suit is made out of to the design of the wings and the arrangement of the airfoil surfaces on the human body.
I hate to ask an obvious question here, but given what it is that you guys are doing, why wouldn't safety be, if not the top concern, then like concern 1A?
There's a little stick cartoon out there that says we finally found something that's more fun than the survival. It's the siren call. This is the fulfillment of that childhood dream of spreading your arms and flying away. And it is compelling. It is the most fun you can possibly have with a prom dress on. Amongst wingsuit flyers, when we're getting on the airplane, we call it our prom dress because you have to carry it around and manage it the same way you would a prom dress when you're climbing in and out of the airplane. But it's a compelling, overwhelmingly wonderful experience, and so it, in some ways, that overcomes the feeling of danger. I'm not a crazy risk taker, and most wingsuit flyers are not. They take their risk in a very calculated, planned fashion. And I guess it's just that idea that you can balance the risk with the reward.
Are you finding that other designers are starting to follow your lead now and look at it more through an engineering lens and with an eye toward safety?
Yes, that is definitely a trend because so many of the elite world-class wingsuiters have died in the last 3 years. Aerodynamics is kind of a mystery. There's very little that's intuitive about it, and there's a lot of what I call pilot mythology out there. Pilots believe that they know what they're doing, and that's kind of a part of the, in order to do that, you have to believe that you're right, but many of the things that they believe are actually wrong, and it isn't what you don't know that kills you, it's what you do know that's wrong.
Timothy Sestak is a professor at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Prescott. He's been working on engineering a wingsuit to try to improve safety and aerodynamics. Timothy, thank you.
You're welcome.
Do you have to tear down old Phoenix to make way for the new? It's a question that's coming up a lot more these days as urban development in downtown Phoenix takes off. And it's the question driving a community to rally behind one historic home on Roosevelt Row. The show's Lauren Gilger takes us to the Worth House for more.
Beautiful Roosevelt Row.
It's a chilly morning on the corner of 3rd Street and Roosevelt in downtown Phoenix, and Kimber Lanning is walking around a fenced-off old house perched on top of cinder block walls a few feet off the ground. But this isn't just any old house to Lanning, founder of business development group Local First Arizona and owner of Modified Arts on Roosevelt Row.
We have to do electricity, plumbing, anything you can think of that a house needs. There's none of that here now. What we have is the foundation, the walls, and the roof. And we're going to preserve as much of that as we possibly can.
Last year, a developer bought the land the Worth House had been sitting on for more than 100 years and announced the 1,100-square-foot brick home would be bulldozed to make way for a new apartment building. It's a story Lanning says is becoming far too familiar as development in downtown Phoenix hits full steam.
All of the properties between 3rd and 5th Street on the north side of Roosevelt were acquired and demolished. To look out my window here now and see everything gone, it's a little bit shocking.
The Worth House was built in 1911 by Felix Worth, a letter carrier who moved here from Kentucky. And to Lanning, demolishing yet another historic building along Roosevelt Row was too much. She hired a company to insert steel beams underneath the house and lift it up a quarter of an inch at a time and move it across the street. It's cost her more than $80,000.
Why go through all of this effort to save one?
To me, it's a small house, but it's a big win. There are a lot of people in Phoenix who feel that we too quickly just tear things down to make way for new development, and sometimes poorly designed new development at that. And if we want to have a quality city that has a unique sense of character, we need to pay more attention to our smaller, older buildings.
We really need this to succeed. If Kimber can help protect this house, it will be a great model for how we can preserve Roosevelt Row.
Phoenix City Councilwoman Kate Gallego's district ends at the corner where the Worth House sits. Though the building didn't qualify for the city's historic property register, she says protecting these buildings is not only about preserving our city's identity. It's a smart business move.
We want to keep those interesting, unique buildings that show our history. So many of our creative artists want to be in unique spaces that have good roots. They look at places like Roosevelt Row, our historic warehouse district, where every building has a story, the decisions were personal, these buildings are unique.
The city had been tossing around ideas about where to move the Worth House when it became clear that Lanning could move a lot faster and cheaper than the city could to work with the building's owners, Gallego said.
They had a live demolition permit in hand when I was finally able to convince them to let me have it.
It was a close call, but the house was moved, and media picked up the story. And that's when the story of the Worth House gets really interesting.
When I was vacationing, visiting family back in Kentucky, I saw on my Facebook feed that the Worth House is saved by Kimber Lanning.
That's Alex Worth. He knew Kimber Lanning. She had been a speaker at the Children's Museum of Phoenix, where he works. And he noticed the name in the story was spelled oddly, W-U-R-T-H, just like his.
We actually have this huge genealogy book at the house. And so I go in there and I'm looking for Felix Worth.
A little bit of digging, and sure enough, there was Felix in his family's genealogy book.
And there's materials that he built his house with there on Roosevelt Row. And so I knew in my heart that I had to be connected and related.
He was right. He emailed Kimber and found out Felix was his great-great-uncle, and he was wrong in assuming he had left all of his family behind in Kentucky.
So I got to meet some cousins. I actually met the daughter of Felix Worth. She's 96 now, Angela.
They all had a family reunion recently. They showed Alex pictures of the house when Angela was growing up there.
I feel like there's too many coincidences for it to be just a coincidence. It's really magical, and it just shows you how small of a world it really is.
It's important that we preserve these stories and these buildings.
Now, Lanning is raising funds to renovate the Worth House so it can be turned into a welcome center for Roosevelt Row and offices for Local First Arizona. And Alex is helping to raise the funds to get the house the renovations it needs. He's holding a benefit for the Worth House at the Children's Museum next week.
I think people need to really think, do we want to have funky, unique businesses that make downtown Phoenix livable and or a destination for those who don't live here? Or do we want to just blade it all and put up new construction that makes us look like every other town USA?
In Phoenix, Lauren Gilger, KJZZ News.
You can see pictures of the Wirth family reunion and the house on our website. Just go to kjzz.org. Joining me in studio now is KJZZ's Steve Goldstein, host of KJZZ's Here and Now, tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Steve, you'll be talking about something with Arizona senior senator, which is not necessarily a new phenomenon for him.
Mark, how would you feel if someone said, you know, anybody but Brody? And that's what John McCain
did. I feel like people maybe have said that in the past, but maybe just not to my face.
So John McCain, Maricopa County Republicans have said anybody but McCain in the Senate primary, because that could mean a lot of support for Senator Kelly Ward. And we're going to talk about that.
That will be an interesting race to follow. Also, the National Geographic series will continue tomorrow.
Right. We'll be talking with cameraman Bob Poole. He'll be talking about the rebirth of one of Africa's great parks. He was born in Africa, has a lot of knowledge, and of course, a lot of great photos.
That's KJZZ's Here and Now tomorrow morning at 11. Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Mark.
The show was produced by our senior producers, Jimmy Jenkins and Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Annika Klein, Regina Revazova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are the digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer. News director Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban. We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. We're at the show at kjzz.org. This is member-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is next at 3 o'clock.